On March 4th of this year, moviegoers will be treated to an all-new adaptation of The Caped Crusader in The Batman. Directed by Matt Reeves, it has become one of 2022's most hotly anticipated films. So to prime ourselves with what Reeves has to offer, we're looking back to when he put his mark on another iconic series. So join us on this episode of Scriptor Screen as we dig in deep with 2014's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another wonderful edition of Scriptor Screen, your number one source for shaky post-apocalyptic alliances. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christopher Kitchen, alongside my other co-host, Zach Strachman.
Zach, that's me.
How are you doing today, Mr. Me?
Chris, podcast hosts together, strong. Podcast hosts, no hurt other podcast hosts.
You are not podcast host.
Oh, well, this is it, folks. It was a good run. I made it 40-something episodes.
I guess this is episode 49, isn't it?
It's something like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're episode 50. Not yet.
We got a good one planned for 50.
Oh, shit. That's our 50th episode.
Yep. It is.
Welcome back. Zach, welcome back, lovely listeners. As always, we are Scriptor Screen. Every week, allegedly, we try to talk about a movie or television series for your entertainment and explore it in all types of different ways. You can find us at our website, www.scriptorscreen.com or anchor.fm/scriptorscreen. There, you can find all of our past, present, and future episodes. You can also find us on social media at Scriptor Screen. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. Leave us a like, give us a follow, share with us your thoughts on the week's episodes, and, you know, let's get this thing going. We, as discussed in the cold open, Zach, we are mere weeks away from Matt Reeves' The Batman.
It's crazy. The almost 3 hour long The Batman.
What are your? I think we briefly discussed this in the last couple episodes, but I am not super excited for this movie, but I also am. You know what I'm saying?
So, Batman movies are not uncommon, either through sequels to Superman movies or Justice League movies. Batman's been around for a while lately, in the cinema space.
Yeah.
So I feel like we haven't had long enough time away from Batman to really make that like, oh, I have to see this, you know. Oh my god. Also, it's another like realistic take on Batman where it's like nitty, like down and dirty and gritty and dark and stuff, and I'm like, this you know, it feels like a Nolan 2.0 almost, but I'm still, you know, jazzed to see it.
I feel like I'm still riding high on Christian Bale. You know what I'm saying? Like I'm still up there. Not that I didn't like Ben Affleck as Batfleck, right? That's what we've come to know him as.
Right.
And I can honestly say I do not care about this Flash movie coming back. You know,
no, bringing, God, no.
Some of these other characters, but you know, all I can say is that I am. I wish I were more excited for this, and I don't know why I'm not. I mean, I know why I'm not, but I'll discuss that later on. It's important. Sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I'm just saying. I think the reason you know surrounding it is that like I feel as if I don't really know much about Matt Reeves. Like when he was announced to be directing this film, I'm like, oh, that'll be cool. But then I'm like, wait, why is it going to be cool if I only know him from very few things? You know?
Right, right.
What are your thoughts?
For me, I was familiar with Matt Reeves' work. I think when the announcement was made. And I think when the announcement was made, you yourself had not yet been familiarized with his work. But when I saw it, I was like, oh, he did the Apes movies and he did Cloverfield. So I'm like, okay, he's a competent director and
but
I like them.
That was it.
Yeah, that was it. And it wasn't anything
wrong.
I
don't
like,
want to discount his television career and his showrunner experience and his writing experience, but like, you know, this is just an interesting thing. It's because it's not like he incepted the apes. You know what's funny? On the Planet of the Apes franchise Wikipedia, they list the original series of films, and then they have the remake as 2001. Then they have the reboot series as The Rise, Dawn, and War. And I'm like, this is so funny that's how they've organized it. They've organized original, remake, and reboot. Tell me, Zach, what's the difference between remake and reboot?
Well, the remake was
just words.
That was the Tim Burton one that came out. So
that's the one with Mark Wahlberg, right?
Yeah, and it's god awful. They tried, you know.
I think I only saw it once.
The one good thing about the Tim Burton one is the practical costumes. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing. Tim Roth, Michael Clark Duncan. When they're in costume as like apes, it looks amazing. Unfortunately, literally everything else about that movie is hot garbage.
Now that you say that, I want to go see it.
Well, again, I mean, just enjoy myself. Enjoy that stinking turd of an ending. anyway, jeez. but you know what? They Hollywood learned their lesson. We in 2011, we got. We're not covering this movie I'm about to talk about, but Rise of the Planet of the Apes came out in 2011. The reason we're not covering it is because this, and we are going to cover War for the Planet of the Apes on another day before the Batman. We're doing the last two Matt Reeves movies leading up to the Batman. Rise of the Planet of the Apes was not directed by Matt Reeves. It was directed by Rupert Wyatt, who, you know, is also good. But it just didn't fit into the schedule and the theme of these episodes. But when Rise of the Planet of the Apes came out, it was kind of a game changer because there were no people in suits. They were like, we're going full mocap, performance capture. Andy Serkis is going to be the lead character. And I remember when the first advertisements or the first like teasers for it came out, and it was just a shot of Caesar in a cage and in the fully rendered CGI ape model, and just watching his eyes kind of move about as he's like looking around the room. Yeah. And I remember back in the day being like, holy shit, this is an amazing effect. And it's only gotten better with the movies that have come out.
Correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't think I am. The main company responsible for the performance capture and the digital, you mean the visual effects, is Weta, the company formerly owned by Peter Jackson.
Yeah, I believe so.
I've confirmed via Wikipedia, the greatest source on the internet. it was indeed Weta Digital. They write here, after considering real apes, instead, Weta Digital created the apes digitally in almost every case performance capture. I like that they considered real primates.
They're like, what if, and follow me on this, what if we trained...
real gorillas. A real orangutan.
They're like, what's the worst that could happen?
Oh, no.
But yeah, and I also didn't want to talk about Rise of the Planet of the Apes because I don't want to give too much of a hype to I don't want to talk up what's his name James Franco too much because he's done some shady shit and I don't want to talk about him. That's true. But that's cool because we've got this great movie, which honestly is better than Rise in almost every conceivable way, and with a whole slew of actors, none of whom, as far as I know, have horrible controversies going on, and a story worth telling. And I think we're going to tell that. So, to kick things off, why don't you find us a nice synopsis to give to the people at home.
Oh, I have a great one here.
Ooh.
This one comes to us from Rotten Tomatoes, which, by the way, Zach, you're right on that. This, on Rotten Tomatoes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes sits at a 90% certified fresh. Which
God
is awesome.
Dang.
Because I didn't see this movie in theaters. In fact, I did not see this film until like maybe 2 years ago. A year and a half ago, maybe. But like super recent, you know? And for no other reason than, I mean, what was happening in 2014? I was starting college. I graduated high school. I don't know. Just like,
okay.
Yeah. Like, I don't know what the hell was going on. I was working or something. Anyways, so the synopsis. 10 years after simian flu wiped out much of the world's Homo sapiens, genetically enhanced chimpanzee Caesar and his ever-growing band of followers have established a thriving colony just outside San Francisco in Muir Woods. Meanwhile, a small band of human survivors emerges, which forces Caesar, as leader, to grapple with the dual challenge of protecting his people and reestablishing a relationship with the remaining human population, the latter being Caesar's secret wish. Oh. Mm. This was a great synopsis.
Yeah,
whoever,
not too bad.
Whoever wrote that, that was awesome.
You get a script or screen golden status, or a golden synopsis award. It's
dude.
It's just an award. It's like a golden like paragraph. It's really
cool.
It's really heavy and unwieldy.
Oh no!
Let's talk about this movie because this movie got a good little group of people behind it. So obviously, as we said, directed by one Matt Reeves, written by Mark Bomback, Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver. Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver, they are returning from Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and they, I believe they also produced the film. Yes.
I just want to post up about some of their other credits right now, because we will be seeing their names again later this year, allegedly.
Allegedly.
in incoming Avatar 2, Return of the Jungle Men.
Return of the Jungle Men! Oh, I'm so excited.
You know, we will see.
Can we confirm on this episode of Script or Screen that they are responsible for all of the Jungleman's lines?
If they don't make the Jungleman return, we're going to have problems.
Oh, man. It's going to be... ladies and gentlemen, it's going to be a great year.
They were also responsible for Jurassic World. They had returned from the first film. They were also producers on Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And more recently, they wrote or helped write the film Mulan, the Disney adaptation.
The live action, right?
The live action, yes, sir. And before then, writing credits are from things that I'm not incredibly familiar with, and I won't bother with mentioning.
So they get around. They know a thing or two.
They've dabbled in big CG projects, it seems, between Rise, Jurassic World, Mulan, and then later this year in Avatar 2, probably the biggest one they could be involved in.
They like their summer blockbusters and their winter blockbusters and their spring blockbusters?
It seems. Ron Burgundy?
All right. So, cinematography by Michael Cerezan. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Edited by William Hoy and Stan Salfus. Music by Michael Giacchino, who is a collaborator with Reeves, worked on this movie, worked on War for the Planet of the Apes, will be doing the music or has done the music for The Batman. I know from what I've heard already, the soundtrack for The Batman's been released on the internet, and it sounds pretty good.
I mean, we saw the one bit. Oh, well, I remember right before the first trailer, but, like, the second trailer came out,
mm-hmm.
Matt Reeves had posted, like, the orchestra, like, you know, composing all the music and everything like that, or just the live recording of it. And then we saw that same track play in the trailer, and it sounds pretty good. It's, honestly, I'm pretty hyped about the music just because there's a lot of complaints and a lot of comparisons between this Hans Zimmer music and like the Danny Elfman themes that they even use in Justice League, but it was from the original. I don't want to say original, but like the Tim Burton film, right?
Yeah, it was weird.
People like that one though.
But like, you know what? I've always liked the Hans Zimmer music from the Nolan movies.
Yeah. You're a proponent of those ones? I enjoy them.
I don't know if they're better or worse. I just enjoy them.
Like about this one and this composer that I got to hear in this film was like there were a lot of I don't want to say like xylophones, but like that type of instrument where they like little
right
thing, and I don't know I think it's a xylophone. I don't know what it is.
A glockenspiel maybe.
I don't even know what the hell that is, Zach. I feel like I've heard that. But I don't know what that is. Anyways, but it seems to be like a bridge between the two, and I'm hoping we kind of get that in this Batman film, which means that this could possibly be the best Batman score to date. Who knows?
It might be. Listen, just going off of one of Giacchino's more recent films, Spider-Man No Way Home, I can say the music of that film was fantastic. It had some extremely high highs. So I am very much looking forward to his work in the Batman. And I really like the work he did in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
I did There's too. A lot of, I thought it was really good.
A lot of rumbling music and
there were, interestingly enough, a lot more upbeat sections.
Yeah.
Than I like anticipated. And I was really listening. Well, I mean, you had to listen to things in this film. Right. Just because the breathing and everything, there wasn't a lot of dialogue. There was just like a lot of, I don't know, Foley.
Yeah, it's a good point. I hope the Foley artists in this movie got paid a lot because...
There's probably a lot more work than they anticipated. Anyways, I want to focus or rewind the clock a little bit.
Yes.
On one of these other collaborators you had mentioned... which would be Michael Saracen, who was the cinematographer for this film. Mm-hmm. He, alongside one of the other cast members, Andy Serkis, also have like a close working relationship because he ended up shooting the Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle, for Andy Serkis, which he directed.
Okay.
And so I thought that was a pretty interesting connection that one, Andy Serkis in these films, also working with Matt Reeves in the Batman, and you know, then we have this whole other section. Everybody in these projects.
I keep forgetting that Andy Serkis is in the Batman.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. That's. I mean, I'm looking forward to it, but I keep forgetting.
I know. We'll see how he compares to Jeffrey Irons. Or Jeremy. Is it Jeffrey or Jeremy Irons?
Jeremy Irons.
Jeremy. Jeffrey is his brother.
Oh, man. Anyway, this movie was distributed by 20th Century Fox, interestingly enough, now owned by Disney, and Disney has gone on record. They are continuing this series. They've already announced that they are in their starting work on new Apes films that take place after War for the Planet of the Apes.
Why?
Because these movies make bank, as I was about to get to, Chris.
Yeah, War had a great ending.
I know, this is going to take place, like, I think, like, decades, centuries. Yeah, but
what are they going to have more problems now? They can't just live in peace?
Bruh, the original Planet of the Apes, the original Planet of the Apes takes place, like, way in the future. So, there's, you know, they can go all over the place. Listen, I'll tell you why they're doing it. Because the budget of this movie was $170 million, and its box office was $710.6 million.
If there's one thing I know Disney wakes up to every morning, it's money in its eyeballs.
Yes. Yeah, seriously.
Cha-ching. Exactly. Let me turn off my alarm.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, hey, I can understand why they would want to make more of these, but it's also interesting because this movie had a very solid return and was a summer blockbuster, which both I find very interesting for a movie with this is kind of like the thinking man's action movie. It's got a lot of, like, psychology in it, and it's got a lot of quiet scenes of apes just signing at each other.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think those things don't really translate to, like, oh, man, like, everyone's got to see this. This is going to be, like, you know, it's a blockbuster. But I guess there's also scenes of apes riding horses dual-wielding machine guns, so...
That is true.
Oh, spoiler alert for 2014's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, because we're going full tilt on this.
If you haven't seen it, you lost chance.
Yes.
Sorry.
That, hey, you know,
it's, not it's sorry. Been, actually, no. Sorry. Not. I it's, take that back.
It's been almost 8 years.
Shame on you.
What are you doing with your life?
It's been 8 years.
Almost.
Oh no.
Let's talk about this cast. As we said, Andy Serkis as the one, the only Caesar.
Performance capture and voice.
Yep.
And breathing.
Andy Serkis is no stranger to ape playing. He played King Kong in Peter Jackson's 2005 King Kong.
Yeah.
And obviously he's not. He
told himself, "I'm going to put on the monkey suit again."
He is basically, I mean, he is Hollywood's pioneer when it comes to performance capture. The world was not ready for Gollum back in 2002, and the world has not been the same since.
I don't know if I'll ever be ready for Gollum again. If Gollum came knocking my front door, I think I would just jump off my balcony.
I would sit him down for some tea, and we'd just talk.
I would serve him some taters.
No, he doesn't know what those are.
Boil them, mash them, stick them in a stew?
I know, but he doesn't.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, Toby Kebbell as Koba. Toby Kebbell, maybe you know him from a few other films. He was in... you know, you don't know. Chris is shaking his head. Toby Kebbell, he was in, what's it called, Kong Skull Island, where he played the performance capture for King Kong. And I think it's funny that the two leads of this ape film have both previously done King Kong performances.
I wonder if they're like the Hollywood's go-to monkey people.
They're like, we need a very convincing ape.
Yeah.
We have Jason Clarke as Malcolm. The humans, their names in this movie really don't matter. It's more about their actions and whatnot. Gary Oldman, the Academy Award winning Gary Oldman as Dreyfus. He was great in this film. Kerry Russell as Ellie. Cody Smith McPhee as Alexander. Judy Greer as Cornelia. I don't know why they got such a talented actress to play a role like this, where she does literally nothing in the film. I don't know. they could have gotten anybody who was just like a lighting person. Hey, come here, just put on this mocap suit. We need you to do something real fast.
I actually wanted to say that it looks as if Toby Kebbell got replaced on Godzilla versus Kong.
Oh,
because
man.
he's not the mocap for King Kong in that film.
Well, maybe his Kong contract.
Maybe his Kong days are over.
Maybe. Nick Thurston as Blue Eyes, White Dragon. No, Blue Eyes. Terry Notary as Rocket. Karen Cannavale as Maurice. These two, they are back from Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And then Kirk Acevedo as Carver. We'll get to him, because he's a character, let me tell you.
So, out of all these names...
Yes.
How many of them are familiar? How many of them slip through? I feel like the names of the apes kind of like... So, our apes, Caesar, Koba... Blue Eyes, Rocket, Maurice. That's it.
You forgot Cornelia.
Cornelia. Okay. Excuse me.
No, the only ones whose like names stand out, yeah, are the ones you just listed. Like,
yeah,
because they're the only ones who get.
I don't think they ever name drop Cornelia.
No, they don't.
That's the thing about these performance captures. It's just that, like, they talk about how these things and just, oh, they speak for themselves. Like, they're really powerful performers. And I'm just like, okay. But, like...
Not all of them.
Not all of them.
Well, we'll get into, like, the other apes a little later as we talk about the film. Because I think that there is some merit in the named apes, the apes who are actually part of the story and not just extras.
Background apes.
So let's talk about this film. I was not... So it's been at least, I don't know, a couple of years since I had last seen this film. I was not ready... I had forgotten that this movie opens up with kind of like where the last movie left off. Last movie ends with a dude getting sick from this like simian flu and he's in an airport and he's like sneezing blood. And then it shows like all the planes going to different things. And you're like, oh, shit, that's how it happened. That's how the apes rose in the planet.
Fell.
Yeah. And so this movie picks up. With, you know, this, the opening
right
scene.
Right at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic.
Basically, because it's like, oh, this unprecedented global outbreak, quarantines and people having to wear masks. And I'm like, wow, this is kind of hitting close to home.
Yeah, it is. It's almost unfortunate that we have to watch this without realizing... And I feel like this isn't the first film we talked about recently that just brings us back to these modern and relatable times.
No, it literally was our second episode where I was comparing Jaws, the reaction to the shark in Jaws to the response that the government had to COVID. So no, we've literally been talking about, we've been comparing movies to the COVID outbreak since like... Script or Screen's birth.
You know, it's because coronavirus is very central to the inception of Script or Screen. So
we had nothing to do at home, and we're like, well, I guess we're starting a podcast. But man, that's just a really freaky way to start.
Very
the film.
Eerie. Yeah,
yeah. But then we get this cool thing. I love it. This movie is bookended, start and finish, with like these close-ups on Caesar's eyes. At the beginning, it starts with his eyes, and then it pulls out to show all the apes. And then at the end, it shows all the apes, and it moves in to frame his eyes.
It's very cool. I like it. There's actually a lot of really great pieces of framing in this film. That one being one, the very first nice highlight. And also, he's got like his war paint on, you know, for hunting.
Yeah,
so that was pretty cool.
Speaking of hunting, I want to talk about that bear scene. Because, listen, the characters... What's great about this movie is, one, I love me a good post-apocalyptic film. Two, the character writing is so good in three apes on horses with machine guns. But let's go back to that number two for a second, because the writing is great. Obviously, spoiler alert... Koba, by the end of this film, is an irredeemable sack of shit.
Oh, you said it.
But as an irredeemable sack of shit that I understand to his core, and I feel sorry for, and I feel like every horrible decision he makes in this film is so true to his character that it's just amazing. But I love this scene with the bear, because the bear shows up, takes a swipe at Blue Eyes, Caesar shows up, but then Koba is there, and he's just got a spear, and he is, like, willing to lay his life on the line to save Caesar, and when he kills the bear, and they look at each other, and they're friends, and they're laughing, and I'm like, this is a dude who, he only turned bad because the human showed up, and if they had never shown up, he would just be, like, Caesar's, like, perfect right-hand man.
Yeah.
Ape. Right-hand ape.
Oh. Well, you know, it's interesting, and I want to get more into Koba later, is that is a very deeply relatable theme, Zach. There's a line in this film where Caesar realizes that ape and man are more alike than he used to think. And that a lot of this film, I think, though we're looking at these animals, right, that have just had intelligence for the last 10 years, or intelligence as we understand it, rather, it's everything is more relatable and like thematically as well. I can't tell you how many times I've been put in a situation where I can see if something wasn't involved, it would have just been fine. But then somebody or something got involved and it's just like, oh God, like now everything not fine. This is my biggest thing is that I felt like after rewatching this film, it's a lot more intimate than I remember. It's not like there's not a lot of grandeur and stuff like that. Like I feel like in the first film, there was like a lot hanging on it, right? There was just like, you know, this kind of world outbreak of all these apes in the zoo and they're attacking San Francisco and all this stuff. And now we're kind of getting into these more intricate stories where, yeah, there's like large groups of these two factions, right? There's the apes and then there's this human colony, but they're not as like big as we thought. And we're not focusing on them like as wholes, you know, or there's not like tens of, you know, little characters that we're looking at. There's not zookeepers. There's not, you know, lab people and not executives or anything like that. It's just, it's very small and intimate moments between a lot of these little characters who are all fighting for the same purpose. And there's a nice duality between all of them. It's really great to see.
I totally agree. You know, there's a lot of, I mean, when you come right down to it, Malcolm and Caesar are just two sides of the same coin. They're both leaders of their communities who are just, they just want their families to be safe.
Yeah.
They just want their people to be able to live, and a couple of assholes in their groups screw everything up for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, I gotta give it to I gotta give it to Reeves. He took the time. He didn't make this just a big dumb stupid action film. He took the time to really let the scenes breathe and let the characters just emote. You know what I mean? Yeah,
for sure. And I also, I mean, that's where we kind of get these strong performances by like our leading, you know, mocap characters. And, you know, I kind of want to move ahead to one of your points here is that a lot of the language isn't spoken. The apes, their form of communication is between sign language and what few spoken words they can actually say.
Right.
You know? And so giving that opportunity to these performers to physically show what they mean in their words and also the way that they breathe and just like, and how they're saying all these little pieces of speech and dialogue given to us all physically adds to like the emotional, you know, weight of everything that's going on at all moments.
It's such a smart move from a filmmaking standpoint because it's very easy like to kind of like point a finger. George Lucas is really bad at scripting emotion. That's why a lot of characters in Star Wars go no, you know, like that's like the famous Darth Vader no at the end of Revenge of the Sith, and it's like people don't usually speak their emotions that way. And when you have a movie like Dawn of the Planet of the Apes where so much is in the looks and in the signing and in the emotion on the faces, and when you give your actors the, you know, the stipulation of you can't speak in this scene or you can speak and you're choosing not to, it makes the actors find other ways to convey those emotions.
Yeah.
And it leads to just these very, very strong scenes. You know, later in the film, Koba goes up to Blue Eyes and, you know, he's signing and he's telling him, you know, I am afraid for your father. I think his trust for the humans will get him killed. And you can see there's like a sadness in his face. And it's like, yeah, I know. He is the one to try and kill Caesar, but I don't believe for a second that he did it out of, like, malice. He did it because he felt he had to do it.
Yeah. Oh, I was also going to say, like, there is a... it's funny to see like the way that they've developed like manipulation tactics too. Because I mean, though you say it, there's not a sense of malice there, like there is a sense of manipulation for sure that's developed at some point. You know, yeah, like
he does that thing where he, you know, Caesar has that thing with him where he holds his hand out and Caesar puts his hand in on Cobra's hand. It's a thing from Rise of the Planet of the Apes that is just kind of meant to be like, oh, he's asking permission. He's asking if it's okay. And when Caesar puts his hand on Cobra's hand, he's saying, okay, we're cool. Like, you're good.
I also want to say, like, that's, like, comes from, like, their need to have an alpha and, like, in, yeah, like, the animal kingdom, right?
Well, yeah. Yeah, he's basically asking permission from the alpha to,
he recognizes Caesar's dominance.
Right. And yeah, so, yeah. And at the beginning of the film, you see he'll go and he'll put his hand out when he's kind of overstepped. Mm-hmm. He puts his hand out, Caesar, you know, swipes his hand, and Cobra gives that time to breathe. But then as the movie goes on, and especially when they have their big fight in the Hydro Dam.
Yeah.
When he puts his hand out and he tells, you know, Caesar to forgive him, when Caesar touches his hand, Cobra withdraws very fast. As soon as they make contact, he's gone. And yeah, it's such little details like that where I just, the acting and the direction of this film are just spot on.
I want to talk about the world building. Because I want to say post-apocalyptic stuff, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that are new happening and a lot of things that have to be rebuilt of sorts. And this film, while moderate in scale, you know, it's not like too big, it's not too small either, they do some really clever things.
Yeah.
And we'll start with the ape colony. Because I love their, I don't want to call it a compound, but I love their commune, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, like, they have formed this really interesting community in Muir Woods, right outside my birth home, San Francisco. And I loved seeing the whole setup of, like, you know, they have, like, their kind of surrounding wall, and, like, they have, like, this really great view, like, what is it, right off of, like, this water or thing like that? Like,
yeah,
it's super interesting. Then we get, like, into the more intricate parts. You know, you see, like, all the baby apes there, and Maurice or one of the other orangutans, or also a Gigantopithecus's, as per one Christopher Walken in the Jungle Book.
Now, remake. Here's my question. Are all orangutans Gigantopithecus?
No. It's just like the one giant one that...
from like way back in exactly, prehistoric times?
Exactly. I just love that name.
Yeah, no, it's a great name.
And I think it's Maurice is the one that's teaching them, but I think there's like a couple of other orangutans, so it could have been any of them.
It's Maurice, for sure.
I love that, like, to teach them how to speak, he will teach them, like, the English, you know, like, Anglo-Saxon language and drawing, like, an A and letters. And, like, on the back wall, they have, like, some of these things written, like, the laws of their society or, like, just general rules that they need to learn. Like, ape not kill ape. Apes together strong. And then the last one, knowledge is power.
it's great. It's all these things. This trilogy is so good about just keeping everything tightly knit together, because these are all lessons that Caesar and Maurice kind of come up with in Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, talking about the apes, again, like in the world building, Maurice and Caesar, they were friends in captivity. That's how they got to know each other. And it's great to see here that, like, Maurice is like one of his lieutenants, basically one of his advisors. Rocket, who's the other chimpanzee, who's kind of like got like grayish skin.
Yeah,
he was the alpha in the ape sanctuary owned by Brian Cox in Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
One Logan Roy, and
fuck off.
Fuck off, apes. And but Rocket was like the alpha there until Caesar, you know, took him down a peg, and now he's very loyal to Caesar, and Caesar freed Cobra back in Rise. And it's all these little things where it's like, listen, I would have you could almost forgive people, you know, filmmakers for going, well, this is a new movie and it's, you know, it's hard to keep track of all the apes. So we're just, it doesn't really, we're not going to keep a continuity of which apes are helping Caesar, because the only ones that are important are Caesar and Koba. But they do the hard work of keeping Maurice, keeping Rocket. It's cool. I love that stuff. That's, it shows such a care for the source material. I wanted to highlight, though, another really interesting kind of like background detail for the film. Kind of like in, talking about world building. When they go to the gas station after after the power's been turned back on, and you can see on the board, like the where it has the gas prices, because this was right before the fall of society.
Yeah.
Where the pandemic was ravaging the world and stuff, but gas prices were like $6 or $7 a gallon, which
yikes.
That sucks.
I don't know if you've seen prices around the country, Zach, if not the world.
Listen, $6 or $7 a gallon. All I can
say is we're gonna have some problems.
Thanks, Obama. but yeah, man, it's just all these scenes are great. Talking about the power coming back on, I want to use that as a segue to talk about some of our human characters, because everyone's kind of, you know, they do a good job. Jason Clarke, he's fine. He's an everyman. He is serviceable for what he needs to do. Everyone's fine. Kirk Acevedo plays a wonderful asshole.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about Gary Oldman. Because Gary Oldman, Dreyfus, my God. I get him so much on a fundamental level. He's a leader. He is scared that he's going to lose his people. And he does not understand this whole thing of the apes. He's like, what the hell are you talking about? He gets the one F-bomb in the whole movie.
Yeah.
And
he gets all... PG-13, we should know.
That's right, exactly. And he also gets maybe the most emotional scene in the film.
Oh, yeah. When you're talking about when the power goes on and...
When the power goes on. So, first off, I want to say, when I was in the theaters seeing this back in 2014, when the little sound of the iPad charging happens, everyone in the theater was like, oh my God. Because like it was one of those things where everyone's like, I know that sound. Oh, that's a good sound.
Yeah. Very relatable.
Exactly.
It's kind of sad now. Man,
when he goes and he starts looking at his pictures, and that scene gets me every time.
Isn't it suck that like one day we're going to be in a society where like physical photos don't exist anymore?
It's exactly what I think whenever I see that scene is like,
oh,
you know,
man,
you never know what you got until it's gone.
It breaks my heart. We don't think about things like that, but you know, it's interesting that moving now from the apes onto the people, like their community is so interesting, the way that they've like taken back some of like the area. And I like it because it's specifically when Kerry Russell and Jason Clarke and his name's Cody Smith, who plays Alex or Alexander. They walk into like the town and you see like everybody kind of hustling and bustling in this place. It's it's kind of cool how, you know, we saw nature take back San Francisco, but then we see the people trying to live on top of the nature that's also taking back San Francisco, like being reintegrated and things like that. Like, you know, it's not that we don't see post-apocalyptic now anymore, but because we're living it, right? but it's just interesting to see it this way versus like I Am Legend, where they make it seem like there's nobody there. You know, right. And it's like I'm kind of over the whole like just lone five people, you know, and I think I don't really watch Walking Dead, but I know that in Walking Dead there are like these little communities of people from time to time, and it's just I'd probably get my fix if I watch that show. But since I don't, this is how I get that fix of like, okay, it's great to see like from time to time not everything's zombie land, you know, or things like that. We're not dealing with like four or five people. We're dealing like, oh, there's communities. There are actually people surviving this thing because they've developed genetic immunity or whatever the hell, which is probably more likely what would happen. You know?
Stay tuned later this year for when we cover HBO's The Last of Us.
Oh, bingo. I thought you were going to say stay tuned later this year for new COVID updates.
That too.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. There's a very interesting kind of structure to the world. You know, you kind of see when different shots of people going through that kind of community they have, where you can see like what it used to be and now what it's become. Like, I think
it's the same thing with like Muir Woods. We saw what it used to be before in the last film, and now we see what it's become for the apes. And so, like, and now it's the same thing. They're going through the same shared experience, which Caesar also points out later on in the film. And really like that.
But let's go. I want to talk about a couple of scenes involving our best boy, Koba, because, man, he gets the best scenes in the film. He really does. I talked about how if on any other day, he would have been a total good guy. He would have.
Yeah.
He's Caesar's number two. He is.
He's strong.
He's strong. Smart. Exactly. And like, so we see him when he first goes to investigate the humans and he finds them at the armory at the National Guard post. And he's seeing all the guns they have stockpiled and stuff. And the two guards find him, and he's smart enough to act like a dumb ape and trick them into letting him go without shooting him dead.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of a funny scene, but it's also like, cause it's, I love the part as he's walking away, you see the dopey smile fade away into like a scowl.
Yeah.
But then of course this turns into maybe one of the most horrifying scenes
Nice slow build up, right? Because it's like there's like two or three of them. I think it's just two.
It's just two of them, yeah.
Yeah, but he formed a small rapport with these guys that he's a dumb ape, and like then he comes back and he plays the part again, and these guys are stupid enough to fall for it again.
And I love the bluntness of it all. It's not just like, it's not played up like dramatically. It's like he comes in, he's playing around, he's joking, he spits the Johnny Walker on them. I know that bottle. That's blue.
Yeah.
Johnny Walker Blue Label. But then
and they're lucky they found that in pandemic times.
You know, it's no one else is drinking it. But he swipes that gun and like, at first, like, you know, you're wondering, like, oh, what's he gonna do? Is he really gonna go that far? And yeah, I just the just sheer I don't even know the word to call it. There's no ceremony to it. He just immediately just kills one of them, and then he just draws up on the other guy and gives the guy about a half a second to beg for his life, and he just guns him down, and it's this extremely dark scene for a PG-13
off-screen
movie.
Visceral, you know, because it's, I mean, like half on screen but very like you know, the depth of field, the focus is on Koba, not on what's happening, but you can kind of see what's happening in the very corner, and it's not for the faint of heart. Very scary.
That's the thing about the, like, you know, when I think of like a sci-fi summer blockbuster, you know, sometimes I feel like the movies, they don't want to be too intense, or they want to present something that's a little more friendly to audiences.
Yeah.
And so they'll have these villains who do villainous things, but the method of which they do it can sometimes be less than lethal. And then you have Koba, who is just extremely lethal. Just like the most like brutal, like, listen, when later on when he goes back to the colony and he's enacting his plan, he pulls Kirk Acevedo just straight through the window of the car and beats him to death.
I did not like that either. I mean, he deserved it though.
No, like, I mean, yes.
I hated his character from the get-go.
Am I Team Koba or Team Carter? I'm Team Koba, of course.
Sure. But am I Team Koba or am I Team... Who was it that he threw? Ash?
Oh, my God.
Oh.
That's when you know it's the point of no return. When
he broke the first rule.
Don't talk about Fight Club?
No, well, the third rule.
Oh. If it's your first night, you have to fight?
Ape, not kill ape.
Oh, right, that one. Man, that scene, though, when he quote-unquote kills Caesar, when he shoots Caesar, and he gets everyone riled up, he, you know, shows everyone the gun and the hat, and he's like, humans kill Caesar, humans burn home and stuff, and I love Maurice just looks at everyone, he's like, run.
That was the best, one of the best moments in the film, because I think that one was also in the trailer, if I recall correctly, or that moment. But I was super, I love that. I wish Maurice would talk more sometimes.
I don't remember if he talks more in War or not, but... I forget. But, I'll you know what?
I've only seen both... Well, now I've seen Dawn twice, and I've only seen War once.
Okay.
But it's a very... I just wish... I liked that moment. I want more of those moments. I want more of his sweet pipes.
Yeah.
You got him. And, use him.
But man, just Koba is—it's just something about him. He is I even when he is committing these horrible acts, I'm like, I kind of get it. I kind of listen. It. I think his character.
His world summed was up, rocked.
His character is summed up in one perfect scene, and it's when he shows up to talk to Caesar, and he's like, "Where's the humans? Or how are you gonna let them in here and stuff?" And Caesar says, "You know." Just let them be. Let them do their human work.
Yes.
And in the human work. And he's like pointing to his scars and he's like, human work. And I'm like, that scene alone, it says everything you need to know about Koba.
Yeah. He is, his tale is very tragic. It's like, extremely. His story is just pure tragedy. Unfortunately, makes for great entertainment.
Yeah.
Or just like very compelling story, though. Like, you know, he is a cautionary tale.
This movie is 100% The Dark Knight to Rises Batman Begins. In that, in a lot of ways, the villain steals the show and kind of outshines the protagonist. Like, obviously, Andy Serkis as Caesar is great. His characterization is just on point. He nails that duality of, like, he wants to be faithful to the apes, but he's also seen the goodness of humanity, and he wants to trust, and he knows that it's in everyone's best interest to work together.
Yeah.
But he can't deny that humans are also capable of a lot of horrible things.
No, that's true. I like Caesar's grounding to it. Like, Caesar is our guide
Batman.
To apes. Yeah, it was our Batman, but he's also like our Alfred too, in a sense.
Yeah.
He's our guide to
Maurice,
ape logic.
Maurice is our Batman. Maurice is our Alfred. So does that make Rocket our Gordon?
No, Zach. What I'm trying to say is that we get a lot more guiding thoughts and background, I feel, from Caesar at times. Like, my favorite piece of information that we get from Caesar relating to Koba is when Caesar and Blue Eyes are reunited after Caesar has fallen, and now Blue Eyes is kind of like split between sides. Like, he doesn't want to be on Koba's side, but he thought Caesar was dead, so
right.
He was upset. And so the line that, you know, as Blue Eyes is telling Caesar about Koba and how they follow him through fear, and you know that he told us to hate humans. Caesar says, from humans, Koba learned hate, nothing else. And
yeah,
it's like, damn.
That's dude. A great, like, line.
It is like, oh, it's the essence, right?
Yeah.
That's his what do you call it? His rosebud.
Right, exactly.
And it's like, fuck, dude. And
yeah,
that's where he'll says, I think in the moment later, it's like, that's where he learns that humans and ape are more alike.
Yeah. Whatever the line is. Yeah, it's and of course he also you know, he admits, he's like, I failed to realize what a threat Koba actually was. I was too convinced that apes were better.
Yeah.
To recognize that Koba was a stinking pile of shit.
Word for word.
All signed out in perfect sign language. Yeah. No, but I mean, it's just, you know.
Otherwise, it's like, what's sheet, Dad?
Exactly. But, no, I just think it's so great. And, again, we get to see, you know, when he gets back to reclaim his title, his alpha dumb, I guess. it's such a triumphant moment. The fight between them is so, like, you know, interesting that it's funny because, like, he goes up there, he's clearly still healing from a bullet wound.
Yeah.
But he's able to wound Koba pretty early in the fight to the point that it becomes, like, relatively even.
Yeah.
But that fight is crazy because they're swinging around. There's Dreyfus sets off C4 and kills himself underneath.
Yeah.
So the whole tower's shaky. When Koba unloads on them with a machine gun, almost kills Maurice, which first time I saw it, I was like, hell no, you don't kill Maurice. Not my orange boy.
Well, I mean, I don't want to backtrack a second, but I do want to say when Blue Eyes was helping the boys escape, out of, like, the school bus, which one, that's where I want to bring back my other point. Like, that was the second, I mean, one of the best pieces of framing in the film before, like, the close-up to reveal that Blue Eyes was there helping out. There's this weird shot where you see, like, in the corner, the rearview mirror of the bus, and that's, they see Blue Eyes back there, and then the next shot after it goes back to them is a close-up to show where Blue Eyes is. I'm like, that was fucking cool.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a point later at night when they're finally breaking everybody out, and one of the Koba apes on the giant bridge, he's, like, shooting at them. Blue Eyes is also shooting at them, like, yeah, spraying and praying. It was like, what the hell are you guys doing? You guys are
also
both missing.
Man, it sucks for the apes that were on guard duty that night, because they got crushed under that bus.
Apes be killing apes. That is not okay.
Listen, first rule goes out the window. It's war.
Yeah, and you know, bringing us back to the Koba and Caesar fight, like, that ending piece, you know, where Koba says to Caesar, like, ape, not kill ape, and he's hanging on, like, Mufasa style.
Mm-hmm.
And then Caesar, you know, breaks his own heart in a sense. Like, a piece of him died that night.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's you hit it right on the nail, right on the head right there, but keep going.
Yeah, he says, Koba, not ape. Or, you are not ape, and then...
No, yeah. The look on Koba's face when he realizes he's about to be dropped is so priceless. It's such a oh shit moment.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, him letting Koba go and letting Koba fall to his death, and I mean, actively choosing to kill Koba, it is such a major thing for him. And we do see that carry into War for the Planet of the Apes. We do see how it's affected him. And I mean, again, spoilers. So, okay, it's funny because at the end of this film, if you stay till after the credits, there is not a post-credit scene, but there's a little bit of audio of, like, a very labored breathing of an ape. And so a lot of people thought when that movie came out that Koba was going to survive and come back, which obviously he doesn't. He's in War of the Planet of the Apes, but just as, like,
He's kind of like a Horcrux.
He's a vision, basically. He's a bunch of tortured visions.
He's a daymare, if you will.
Exactly. Yeah. But that's the level of, like, impact that Koba had. And that's like, I feel like, the staple of an amazing villain is, like, when everything's wrapped up, people weren't like, and now we'll never talk about him again. It's like, no, it's like, Koba got in there, did some fucking damage, and then left.
Yeah. And that's...
But...
super sad too. I like though that we kind of got that. I don't want to say we got that like foreshadowed when he dropped Ash, but it's just like I think in that if the moment where he shot Caesar wasn't it, then it was the moment that he dropped the ape from the right. the top of that place. You know, just because like they don't do that; they're not supposed to.
Yeah.
Or at least like by their own laws, like that's not okay. Also, I hate the common theme in the world that when apes don't like weaker creatures that they go to high places and drop them. You remember that article I sent you about like yeah. this one place where all the monkeys, they took all the puppies and they were dropping them from buildings, and it's like, oh my God, I became so scared for my dog.
If only the,
and I don't even live there.
Of all the apes that are around your area, right?
Yeah.
We're in Florida. The only ape we have to worry about is Skunk Ape out in the Everglades.
Dude, Skunk Ape. Shout out Skunk Ape.
That's our resident South Florida cryptid.
You know what's funny? I drove past. I was working on a shoot with a buddy of mine, and we were driving way out west, and we drove past the Skunk Ape headquarters. It's like
mid-Everglades. Yeah.
It's like an hour and a half west of Miami. Like you're beyond Coopertown. You're like, oh... It was
that's
awesome.
When you start hearing banjo music.
Yikes. I actually Googled it. They have a really great hot sauce stand inside, and I wanted to check it out.
Nice.
You want to take an hour and a half drive with me out in the middle of nowhere?
Hell yeah. We'll go hunt some skunk ape. We'll teach him, you know, skunk ape, no kill human. but yeah, so I don't know. I think as far as I'm concerned, you know... Reeves, his direction was solid. It was there's nothing I feel that was like mind blowing. Like there's I think the best shot of this film is the one-er on the tank.
Yeah.
Like when Koba gets on that tank, rips the people out of it, kills the person inside, and it's just that spinning shot of like all the way up to the front of the humans colony. But, you know, nothing besides that really wows. It's all very competent filmmaking.
Yeah, I would agree. Like, the thing about this film is that, like, super well put together, you know, like, very well organized. But just based off this film and how I think about the future of Matt Reeves and Batman, the only things I really have to go off of are Cloverfield and then mm-hmm. this film. And so thinking about that, I am much more of a fan of this film than I am of Cloverfield, just because Cloverfield is a very niche film in a way.
I like Cloverfield.
Right, but like the handycam kind of, you know,
found footage
style.
It's an acquired taste.
Exactly. It's an interesting form of filmmaking. But this is a more traditional form, and it's great to see a capable director that can do it. But the question can be asked, could another director have done the same thing? And when I see this film, I think yes. I feel like he had the benefit of not writing this film.
Yeah.
So there's that piece that's kind of out the window. He's not necessarily an auteur with this either. And from his filmography, I don't get the sense that he's an auteur either way at all.
No. If I said, oh, give me the staples of Matt Reeves filmmaking, I'd be
I have none, you know.
They're good.
So, I mean, this film alone does not get me super excited for the Batman because of Matt Reeves. If anything, I'm just excited for the Batman because of like the actors and the performers that are in it, and the music and other things like that.
I totally agree.
However, I can start to see when I think more about War of the Planet of the Apes and the Batman, more of a relationship where now we get some of Reeves' things. And I think it's because of his contribution to that film. And it's writing, you know, we talk about like the lasting effect of what Koba mm-hmm. will have on Caesar. I think about something like that. And then I can think about the relationship between Caesar and Bruce Wayne. And I'm like, okay, you know, we'll discuss that in the future episode.
That's an interesting teaser for what's to come ahead.
Exactly. So stay tuned. But overall, great film.
Yes.
Definitely worth the watch if you haven't seen it. And, you know, if you want to become more familiar with this filmmaker as we come toward... I don't know, we're in a world where, like, certain filmmakers being involved with certain, you know, big franchise projects can be both very excited and also very, you know, who the fuck knows what's going to happen kind of situation. Right.
Yeah. But I'm hoping that, you know, we get more of this and of War for the Planet of the Apes style, level of quality in the Batman, which I'm confident we will. I don't think they would have handed him this movie unless they were confident he could do a good job. And from everything I've seen in the trailers, it looks good. It's just, you know, hey, it's another Batman film. I'm not exactly like, I haven't been starved for Batman, so the desire, the demand is not there.
You know what I predict? I predict that if this film is a huge success, the demand for the sequel of the Batman, the Batman 2 is going to be much bigger than the demand for this film, as I think was with the relationship of Batman Begins and Dark Knight.
I think
it's exactly going to mirror that.
You raise a good point. Maybe the Batman 2 will be the Dark Knight to the Batman's Batman Begins. So
maybe I didn't say that correctly.
But you know what? I think that just about does it for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I always get these names confused, and they're so long. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. They really got to fix up their situation. I'm telling you, go to their Wikipedia of the franchise. It arranges the films as original films from in the titles to then remake Planet of the Apes 2001 to then reboot series. And then and I'm like, dude, one Wikipedia, tell me the difference between remake and reboot. Tell me right now. Tell me, well, like, the definitions, Zachary.
Yeah.
It's the same word.
I guess, like, if you're remaking it, it's like you're trying to adhere to the original. Whereas if you're rebooting it, you're putting your own spin on it.
Go suck a fuck.
Okay, I will go suck a fuck. Well, ladies and gentlemen.
I guess that was obvious.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this has been a delightful time. Once again, script or screen. I don't think we have anything else to say except, we'll be coming to you, and our next episode will be our 50th episode. We have a very exciting, controversial topic.
Oh, super exciting, controversial. We're going to take 1 week break before we get back to War, and, you know, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Very just stay topical. Tuned, because it's gonna be pretty exciting. Let me tell you.
Yeah. Anyways, Zach, thank you for being here for another fantastic edition of Script or Screen.
Of course, all the time.
I thank myself for being here. Remember, lovely listeners, you can find us, Script or Screen, on our website, www.scriptorscreen.com or anchor.fm/scriptorscreen. Hey, Script or Scream, that's our spooky
stuff. Halloween's come early, folks.
It works as a mobile website. You could find us on the Anchor app. You could find us on all your podcast apps. It works like that. It's awesome. Listen to all the episodes. Find us on social media. That's at Script or Screen, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. There you can communicate with us. Let us know how you feel. What do you think about the new look? We worked on a whole new look for this year. You know, it looks awesome. We love it.
I think so.
What do you guys think? Anyways, everybody, have a wonderful rest of your day.
Bye.